Hello and welcome to History Hack. Jumping straight out of sharpshooters and well into the mainstream, this is Marcus calling without any Alex or Alina, kind of been let off the leash with three great gents tonight, all of whom you've heard before, some as a regular. Coming first, we've got Andy Dorman from down the pub. How are you doing, Andy?
I do other things too.
He lives down the pub.
There's an Irishman in our pub, and he actually knows about other things. Yeah. How's it going?
You good? Yeah, actually, you're here talking about your mainstream area rather than just comedy. You actually are a kind of 1700s British military researcher, PhD, and supervisor. That's your main area, isn't it, really?
Yeah, let's not talk too much about the British element, lest I lose my passport. But yes, no, it's the British Army in Ireland.
Cool. Keep your passport, that's okay.
Yeah.
And then linking in, only been on one podcast with us so fast, but I think probably going to be coming back for a few more. We've got Robbie McNiven, not only a published science fiction author, which Dorman and I have got a few books, but also done quite a few on the American Revolution. Isn't that right, Robbie? How are you doing?
Hi, guys. Yep, I guess so. Really laying on the whole geek label thick there. But yeah, I write both made-up stuff and non-fiction. So I don't know. I just, you know, try and get paid in this day and age. You know, I do whatever.
Always a good plan to get paid.
I'll do my best.
Yeah, you're in safe hands with the geek labels here between us, definitely. And then kind of the master of all areas, you've heard him come on here and talk about African kings, Hawaiian kings, recent conflicts and soon-to-be musketeers and everything too. It's a good friend of mine, Josh Provan. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm looking forward to getting into the 18th century for a change.
Into the 18th century. So, yes, that's what we're doing tonight. We're going to talk about the British Army kind of emerging as a formed unit into the Kingdom of Great Britain. So the 1700s. This is when it is just Great Britain, and we are talking the end of the Stuarts and the beginning of the Kingdom of Hanover, the beginning of the Georges. And this is a whole new era, well before my main stream. Napoleon's not even a glint in the milkman's eye yet, and, well, same as Wellington, born the same year. So he's not there to counteract the whole thing. And what we've got is a completely different era. We're coming out of the turbulent times of the English Civil War and the Restoration of the 1600s, and that's where we kind of saw the transformation from a king's army and different units being formed ad hoc to a standing army. A British army, the new model army, kind of, well, I guess an English army, before anyone jumps on me, as it was. And they're transforming slowly into a professional fighting body. Regiments then were mostly named after their colonel of the time. So you would have Sir Howard's regiment, for example, and they'd be named after each colonel as it changes. They don't have the famous numbering system, which came in later, and that links into where I kind of study in the Napoleonic era, where you would have the Gloucestershire regiment, and they would have a number and their regiment. So you'd have like the 28 Gloucesters and then their number. And actually slowly the names kind of start to become more prominent, and you'd know them then as the Durhams later on. But the numbers are there. And this is before that. And the kind of the first conflict we've got is under Churchill, but not Second World War Churchill. We are talking the soon-to-be Marlborough. Josh, do you want to give us a bit of a summary of Marlborough? I think you might know quite a bit about him.
Well, thank you. I'll be happy to try anyway. And of course, everybody will let me know in the comments if I missed it. So, John Churchill, first Duke of Marlborough, was one of the most preeminent soldiers of his age. For many people in the 18th century, he remains the British soldier to look back on. People like, in fact, it's very difficult to find another general from Britain who commanded this type of respect, not only in Britain and in the British Army, but in Europe as well. until Weddington, really. And Weddington himself said that he could conceive of no greater thing than Marlborough at the head of an English army once. Now, John Churchill was an interesting chap in himself. He came from an old royalist family, which stayed loyal despite losing the in the Civil War, but that turned out well during the Restoration. And they were restored to favor. He got his start, however, because his sister was the mistress of the Duke of York, and also he himself took up with one of Charles II's mistresses, and this was one of the various ways a soldier, an officer, and a gentleman in those days could get ahead, and he ended up in the Guards. Although after he may have actually been sent to the Tangier garrison to get him out of the way for a while, but there's actually no firm confirmation that he ever served there. The War of the Spanish Succession was his proving ground. It was the moment where he stepped onto an international stage and became renowned as a great soldier. This is coincidentally also the time when the British Army begins to be seen as something of a respected fighting force, and the deployment of troops on the continent in what was known as the Confederation or the Grand Alliance of the time against Louis XIV, France and his allies was the largest deployment of British troops to the continent, possibly in ever, actually, up to that point. And Marlborough, now due to another connection of favour, because his wife was very, very close to Queen Anne, got the job of commander of the British forces and the principal army in 1704, which was tasked to deal a crippling blow to Louis XIV's army, and they did this by listening to Marlborough. And Marlborough had this crazy idea that he could march an army from the Low Countries to the Danube and knock Bavaria out of the war, and at the same time stop the French and Bavarians from attacking Vienna and knocking the Austrians out of the war. This was an incredible feat of logistics, and it was handled expertly by Marlborough. This is an immense amount of miles to cover. It's seen as one of his masterpieces, and it's really weird because in a way it was his first testing ground, because he'd only commanded in the field in a sort of a secondary capacity prior to this, where he had been effective commander at the Battle of Sedge Moor during the Monmouth Rebellion.
I was just going to say that is something that Marlborough is known as mm-hmm. being a kind of a master of logistics and manoeuvre. But just help everyone picture it. I don't know if the other gents want to jump in. The regiments, the army. Are we talking red coats? Are we talking 10 companies? Robbie, I'm pretty sure we're not talking any light infantry here. What's the discipline like? How paint me a picture, guys, of what the army, how the army looks different to Chartres, Waterloo, God, even the Patriot. How's the army different at the early 1700s to how we kind of know it from many films?
They've got much bigger cuffs.
uniforms, lots of legs, bigger hats.
They're just longer and more ungainly, and there's also more variety. There's not a pattern per se, but I suppose each colonel is given the liberty to equip their men how they see fit. Although at the same time, they're still expected to be, you know, red coats, facings. Yeah. But you'll have a fair bit of individual difference between the different units, though, be that buttonholes or button facings or hat trim or what have you. So there's a bit of variety. Yeah, it's quite a colourful force, but mainly red.
Mm-hmm. Pretty red. I believe lots of lace and bigger hats. I think they had the same musket, but they were just longer. Is that right?
I mean, I think the first, so like the musket during this period is first the long land pattern, then the short land pattern, and then the India pattern is the Napoleonic one. I think the first long land is 1722. Could be wrong about that. So I don't really know what system they had in place. I mean, I'm sure they were all sort of manufactured to spec, but I don't know what they would have called the particular sort of type. But yeah, they were long.
They were long.
Yeah.
7 inches barrel, maybe. Maybe shorter than the short.
Quite a bit longer. Yeah. I wonder if that had a little bit of effect. Probably longer to reload slightly, more ungainly, but firing a musket, my analogy is always chuck a tennis ball down a drain pipe and it roughly goes forwards, but it could go left a bit, could go right, could go up, go down. Hence the, I'm presuming we're onto the big volley fire, everyone being very strict.
Let's bring you a picture of a regiment in Marlborough's time. So you have 10 companies, and at one point there might have been two grenadier companies, but commonly you would have one. That stood on the right of the line. They wore funny tall hats that looked like Pope hats, richly embroidered with the, not the king's crest necessarily, but possibly even the colonel's crest. At this time, the colours that stood in the centre of the regiment, there were three of them, the colonel's colour, the monarch's colour, and the national colour. Therefore, you would have a St. Andrew's cross if you were a Scottish regiment, a George cross if you were an English regiment, the Union flag, which represents the monarch, and the colonel's colour, which is the regimental facing colour, and the colonel's crest in the centre. The colonels, like Andy just was pointing out, they pretty much dictated the cut and style of the uniform, which at this point was actually quite simple, but in a way more elaborate than what you get later on. Very big cuffs.
Yeah, Norman's rightly pointing out, actually, even on the Union flag, obviously it's a personal Union Ireland, we're not getting a lot of Irish representation at this point. Were there Irish regiments? You can face this early on, Dorman. So the regiments who were recruited in Ireland, were they fighting under
flag
of St. Peter's?
I feel bad for cutting across Josh's excellent rundown of the regiment there. So it's technically illegal to recruit Irishmen into the British Army at this stage. Reason being, you need the Irish Protestants here to keep the Catholics in line, and for God's sake, don't teach the Catholics how to shoot straight. So because of that, any Irish recruiting that does take place is pretty clandestine. You've got cases of Irishmen being moved to Scotland and then being recruited in Scotland as Scotsmen, that kind of thing. But you don't have the same that kind of homogenous Irishness until later on in the century where things get more desperate. But in the early period, as Josh mentioned, most of the veteran Irish soldiers are wearing red, but they're shooting at the redcoats. They're in the service of France. I presume we're going to come to Blenheim. There's only three regiments in French service.
I have this vision where they try to like make a film about Blenheim, but it's Patriot level accuracy, and you have Irish regiments with Irish tricolours.
Yeah, the green.
That's the level it would be at. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how that is.
Exactly.
Yeah, there is, and I'm criminally going to not remember the exact name of it, there is an Irish regiment in the British Army, and they have, as a cipher, on their crest, a harp. It could be the Royal Irish, or what became the Royal Irish. And there's a famous moment during the War of the Spanish Succession where they come up against the French Irish. And there is a there's actually a famous account by one of their officers which talks about the types of volley fire that the both sides used, where the French and Irish service used the rank-by-rank volley by battalion, and the Irish and British service use by platoon, which of course we can try and explain, but it's very complicated to explain platoon firing system without diagrams. But the regiments pretty much looked, as I said, big baggy coats, big sleeves, simple hats. Not actually a lot of lace at this period, though the dragoons look rather splendid. And officers, however, are very splendidly attired because the officers are not required to dress like their men. In fact, it's actually encouraged that they dress differently. So you can tell who the officers are. Discipline's very tough. In Protestant armies, it tended to be rigorously tough. So you would get, if you blasphemed, you could be flogged or put on the wooden horse with weights tied around your ankles. If you were found sneaking women into the camp, that's the same. Obviously, death for various sundry offences in the face of the enemy. And a very curious one called the whirligig, which is essentially a large birdcage. You lock the offender in it and you spin it until they lose control of their bowels. It's maybe not as scarring as the lash, but I think it will leave an impression.
That's like a teacups ride gone on acid.
Yeah. Like we were saying before, they're all armed with a type of musket. I believe it's a type of long pattern musket, which is about 42-46 inches long, 68 caliber bore. And the new, and you stress this new triangular section socket bayonet, which was introduced supposedly after General Hugh Mackay had troubles with it fighting the Jacobites in Dundee's rebellion.
And that's the itself. So this is a bayonet that goes into the barrel rather than locking around the outside. So once it goes in, you've got to make the decision. You can no longer load
well,
your weapon. It's become a big pike, isn't it?
Yes, that was Mackay's problem. That was the plug bayonet. And the stuff Marlborough's chaps have now is the socket, which is what we all know as a true bayonet, which slots over the barrel.
They're light bulbs from.
Exactly. And they're all attired
the
with...
The best light bulb.
the easy light bulb. the everyman's friend light bulb. So apart from that, you have a big sack that you wear over your back that you put all your stuff in. It looks kind of like a looks like a deflated balloon, really. And a big old cartridge box, sword or hanger, carrying X amount of rounds, and you wear gaiters on your trousers, large gaiters, which Marlborough preferred black gaiters, but you would be brown or white. Or like everybody was saying earlier, there's a little bit of variation at this time. And actually, you could be using something called a doglock musket at this point as well, because, again, the colonels are providing the weapons. And so it kind of depended in the Spanish Succession War what they could get a hold of and what they liked.
That's really important. At the time, the kind of acquisition of arms is at regimental level. So it's down to the colonels buying stuff. So we see a real variation between the regiments, the colonels who may be a little bit dishonest and like pocketing the profits, or people who just kind of buying off the shelf, and those who are buying, you know, top level stuff and shelling out for it, don't we? We see quite different arms and armor, like, and Dorn was saying, different uniforms, some are going to be more flamboyant. So there's not this like general uniformity across everyone.
Yep. And there's not actually one drill manual either. That all depends on the various, which colonel likes whatever drill manual is available. And that brings us a little to what we brought up earlier, which is the platoon firing system. Does anybody want to take a crack at explaining that without diagrams?
I don't, but I would like to ask you a burning question. Who won the engagement between the British Army and the French Army Irish?
British.
Do you know? Or was it?
Yeah.
Say that a little bit louder, Dorman. I don't think
it was the British. I did my thesis on this.
It was. It's Captain or Lieutenant Parker, is it?
Yeah, it's Parker, yeah.
It was just because it reminded me, I think I'm right, it might be wrong. We had an almost identical engagement between Scots at Ranelagh's between a Scottish regiment in the French army, so ex-Jacobite basically, and a Scottish regiment in the Dutch army, so not the British army, but allied with the British, you know, like all Protestants. And they also had a crack at each other. I believe it was the Dutch Scots that won that one, so there we go.
Is that Protestant work ethic going into battle for them?
Probably platoon fire as well, because the Dutch were the ones who invented platoon fire. And they're the ones who taught the Brits how to do it. So I'll give it a go. A platoon doesn't necessarily mean what it does nowadays, where you have several sections. Well, actually, you probably did have sections, but you're looking at each company divided into components. I'm not sure how many there were. Feel free to
up to three, I think.
Yeah, and then these would fire by in section as opposed to
Every company.
Yeah.
Fire.
So you have, instead of the back rank firing, you have a staggered effect where you would have parts of the line firing and reloading at each time. So it's a more continuous thing. You're less likely to have long periods of pause, and it's a more sustained barrage of very heavy lead balls coming out your face.
Yeah.
It's a ripple effect, isn't it? It gives a continuous amount of fire when one platoon fires, and the next, that will hopefully give time, because you've broken the companies down into platoons, that by the time it reaches the last company's last platoon, so like let's say 20 or 30 sections, the first one's then fired again. So it's a continuous, 20 or 30 seconds to reload a musket. It's a wave, it's a wave, it's a wave, which doesn't let up that on the casualties, there'll obviously be less than one big volley. It means that the enemy are receiving a constant amount of casualties, especially as these engagements are incredibly close range. Cannon fire is still over several miles, but musket ranges, we're always talking about 80 yards effective range. They can fire more than that, you're not going to hit a lot. So they can end up being very close engagements, which must be a nightmare for deciding when to put a plug bayonet in.
Well, remember, the plug bayonet is not a thing anymore.
Yes, yeah. Going out Highland charge. And so that paints a great picture, thank you. And we're kind of coming on to Blenheim.
We have completely forgotten the cavalry, but that's fine.
Gents like that. We'll mention the cavalry at the end, and they'll do what they always do, which is sweep in, take all the glory. Fine. So that brings us on to Marlborough's great victory at Blenheim. And without going into too much detail, this really is a sweeping success. And he's lauded with huge riches and titles. If anyone hasn't been to Blenheim Palace, as soon as it opens, it is vast. Huge lands, titles, and everything that goes with that. What kind of reforms does he institute that stay in, at least for this century?
Well, like many British generals who command in the field, it's very much a war thing. I don't know if anybody else would agree with that. Reforms move slowly, and I believe it was said in the 19th century by a French officer or writer that a soldier of Louis XIV's army would be able to take his place in the ranks of Napoleon's army and almost immediately know what to do, because practically nothing that mattered, really, except in matches of drill, had really changed very much.
Would you two agree? Is that fair? Could a soldier at Blenheim fight at Waterloo?
Yeah, like, I kind of want to be counterfactual and say, oh, well, that's just what someone would think about the 18th century, but in reality, our topic is so complex and so much has actually changed. I don't know if I can actually say that. I mean, I think the restrictions of technology, I mean, the musket is just shortens its barrel through this period. I mean, it's not changing. It's, minor semantic tweaks to drill manuals. When we come to American stuff, I can talk more about, like, platoons.
I was just going to say, you have a great subject to introduce about certain types of soldier, though.
I think it's pretty fair to say that the experience of conflict is pretty similar across the century, probably in the same way that the experience of conflict, in previous centuries, if you take someone from, say, like the early 1300s to the late 1300s, there's definitely differences, but we probably don't get as vast a change as we do from 1900 to 2000 anywhere else in historical periods. So it's not like, oh, there's nothing happening in the 18th century. It's just, yeah, that's just how technology works, I suppose.
They hadn't moved on much.
At the same time, though, while their combat experience might have changed, the experience off the battlefield has evolved substantially across that period. Because, I mean, the army is a very new thing at the beginning. And one only has to look at the number of mutinies that happened directly after the War of the Spanish Succession to realize that maybe reform was needed at home, and things do start to improve or change, or however you want to put it, as the century wears on. But I think there's something like 4 or 5 in Ireland alone in 1717. So there's definitely room for improvement there.
Okay. Well, I mean, one of my favorite facts you're saying about the battlefields being the same is that Marlborough spent a night in Papelotte Farm and wrote in his diary that it was the best place to defend Brussels from the south. And that basically is Mont-Saint-Jean, where Wellington set up Waterloo. And we know that he read those diaries, and it's just kind of conjecture whether he remembered that because he read it when he was shipping out to India, or he just had the same eye as Marlborough. Definite circle back to that. Discipline and mutiny, very relatively unusual in later conflicts for the army. They were kind of like case by case. A few men might decide to like shoot one of their officers and they'd shoot them. So is this large-scale mutiny? What's happening there, Lindorman?
So this is something I'm hoping to delve more deeper into as I continue on with this stupid PhD I'm doing. But you have several... At first, it's mainly over pay, because I think the administration isn't really in place to handle pay packets at this stage. And because it's at the behest of the colonel to supply the pay, often there's back pay and that sort of thing. And some regiments, it's too much for them. And they just... outright say, we will take up arms if you do not sort this out. And they're usually talked down from that stance. However, as sort of the years go on, you also have issues with disbandment and sort of moving men around, where men are moved from one regiment to the other. Maybe they don't want this, or they're just going to lose their job. And you have one mutiny in particular, I think it was in Athlone, but don't quote me on that, where the men march out onto parade knowing that they're probably going to be disbanded, with powder and ball under their hats. So they're carrying their pieces and they have their hangers, and they're told this is happening. So they immediately all take off their hats, load their muskets, and march out of town. And it takes several loyal regiments to come back and sort of rein them in. And there is an exchange of fire, and eventually they are put down. So it's not the sort of, I know there's an image of sort of this bloody back disciplines throughout the century, but it takes a while to get to that point, at least I guess in Ireland. Maybe it's just the backwaters, I don't know.
I mean, even if you think about the Black Watch mutiny in 1743, about 139 men just decided to go back to Scotland because they didn't want to serve in the West Indies. They weren't actually going to the West Indies, they were being sent to Flanders, but they thought it was the West Indies. And only, I think, 3 of them were executed for that mutiny. So there's more at play.
That bears out with the Irish examples as well. You've got the ringleaders killed, but the men themselves are told, just get back in line. Just do your job. Stop messing about.
I'm presuming they needed the men, actually. You just couldn't afford to shoot a whole regiment. And, yeah.
If they're going to be disbanded anyway, you'd think, why bother? But clearly these guys aren't motivated.
My stupid generalisation is normally when a regiment's disbanded, they're normally, in the history books, called back up within 1 or 2 years, maybe under a different name, but they're normally needed for another war. This is a century of war and conflict, isn't it, really? More than any other. We don't really get a long period of peace.
The War of the Austrian Succession is a result of Maria Theresa taking the throne in Austria and Europe thinking that she's not going to do a good job. So Frederick the Great, having basically taken his dad's pet project, which was the army, and thought, I'm going to use this. I apologize for the paraphrasing I'm doing to European history here, Josh. But
don't worry about it.
Frederick invades Silesia in Austria, and then the rest of the European monarchs just circle like hawks. Britain gets involved and sort of allies itself with the Netherlands and Austria. It's kind of the League of Augsburg brought back together one last time. And they march against the French. They win the Battle of Dettingen, and then they get slapped at the Battle of Fontenoy. pretty embarrassingly, to be honest. Now, that was Cumberland at the head, Butcher Cumberland, who did instill a lot of reforms as a result of this. Mm-hmm. But really, he blamed it on the Allies, and there is probably a case for that, but it's not the high point of the period, shall we say.
No, not for the British Army. In fact, it's a definite low point because officers don't act in the way that they thought officers didn't act in ways that they should have acted and things like that. They are sometimes too reticent. They were inexperienced field commanders like the Duke of Cumberland, and De Saxe really taught him a lesson in what not to do at Fontenoy. And of course, bringing up Cumberland and tying that together with the experience of the battlefield that Andy was talking about before, you have the curious case of the British Army being called upon to fight the last great Jacobite rebellion. And again, that's a pretty mixed performance, to be honest, because they lose the early battles, and these even regular troops having to face the Highland charge break in front of it. And this is a very scary moment because actually it gives the French, it should have given the French the opportunity to actually invade threaten to invade and help topple King George, to be honest. But it didn't work out that way, ended up in disaster at Culloden. Interestingly, what we were talking about platoon fire before, General Hawley, Hangman Hawley, as they call them, had the theory that you could not face the Highland charge unless you fired by rank. From between 10 to 12 paces, when the Highlanders were 10 to 12 paces from you, each rank was to fire successively, obliquely towards the center of that mass of madmen. And he said that that was the only way to stop it. Bear in mind, he never actually did.
I mean, he's basically treating the Jacobite charge as a cavalry charge. I mean, you don't face cavalry with platoon volleys, you need battalion volleys. And the range thing is ridiculous. I can't actually remember. It's been covered in some detail as to how they delivered fire at Culloden. I think it was by battalions, and they got about two volleys in.
And it didn't work. The Highlanders cut through the 4th Foot and turned the flank of the 37th. And it was only General Husk's second line which came up to contain the breakthrough that stopped the charge from working, because the difference between Culloden and, say, Falkirk or Preston Pans was that the line did not break. It was cut through. So the infantry actually stood and took it at bayonet point, which is testified by the fact that most of Barrels, the 4th Foot Barrels, Colonel Barrels' regiment, had bent bayonets, saber cuts and bad cuts and lacerations to their arms and stuff, and interestingly telling things like that. But that was an unusual instance in terms of what the British Army had to face. Generally speaking, they had to deal with the platooning worked so long as you weren't fighting an essentially medievally driven sort of tactic.
It's interesting as well that at Fontenoy, the Black Watch employed strange, irregular, Highland tactics.
Yeah.
And volleys, and then kind of getting down on the ground to reload and then jumping up again.
I know.
Stuff like that. So it's interesting that they had the leeway to do that within the structure of the British Army.
They did, because they actually, the colonel actually asked permission for his men to fight in Highland style. And they all knew what that meant, even though they'd been drilled as British soldiers. So when they went to attack, they did the old Highland thing where they dropped to the ground as the volleys came at them, fired back, and then charged with their broadswords, which all Highland regiments had at that time.
And in the French service, the commander of the Irish or one of the Irish regiments, was the Viscount Clare, who was then tasked with leading the French army that was going to invade afterwards, but because of Culloden, he never actually got to invade Ireland again, as he had been promised. So it's all interwoven and interconnected.
Mm-hmm. But that does take us to the Seven Years' War. I mean, it's skipping over a very interesting period of...
Sorry, Marcus, we derailed your podcast.
No, this is great. So there's so many things going on here, and of course we really should talk about the Jacobite rebellion. We haven't even mentioned the kind of motivations behind that and the king over the sea, which is one of my favourite little like kind of quirks and toasts of the era is going on. And there's so much there to kind of unpick in culture as well as in history. And the kind of it's one of the biggest what ifs of history, for English history maybe, for what could have been if a different king had been on the throne. But again, I come back to the question: apart from like we were talking about firing obliquely, so we're talking at a slight angle, in layman's terms, we're not seeing many developments over this era, many changes. Don, thinking
there was the sort of famous semi-mythical bayonet drill used at Culloden, which is fun to talk about. I'd volunteer at the visitor centre when it's not closed down. it's fun to talk about because it's one of those things that people who aren't really into history say, oh, they actually won because of this special technique that they learned before Culloden. The idea was that a Jacobite Highlander armed with the shield, the targe, and the broadsword, as he rushes at you, he will raise his right arm with his sword exposed, the gap underneath, and so rather than you fighting with your musket and bayonet, the Jacobite coming at you, you would thrust the Jacobite to your right as he raises his sword to hit your mate, so you catch him in this unprotected part and stab him through, which looks great on paper, but obviously the reality of a battlefield conditions, it probably didn't really do anything. I think so much as it was used and was effective, people have said it was potentially, it gave the regulars the sort of the mindset and the courage to stand and use their bayonets, mm-hmm. as opposed to just running as soon as they made hand-to-hand contacts with mm-hmm. these guys with swords and shields. So it might have contributed to the fact that
barrels... And that had happened a lot before, hadn't it? The Highland charge had been successful, and the line regiments had broken.
Yeah, I don't think there was ever a case of a line regiment withstanding a Jacobite charge when it reached them, was there?
There was one at Falkirk. Right. Coincidentally, it was the 4th Foot and the 37th again that stood at Falkirk, although, to be fair, they did not meet the actual full force of it. It was sort of spent by the time they had to deal with it.
As always, I'm just in awe in Josh's brain that he can pick out a particular battle, a particular regiment, the year, and possibly what state the moon was in that day. there's one. The Highland Charge.
And that's just a blip, and it's not really a thing. It's a fun history book thing, but in reality it probably wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, the bayonet drill, like, I find it kind of absurd that people have laid so much stress on it, because, first of all, not every Highlander used a sword. A lot of them had muskets or pole arms, and also it also assumes the Highlander will not stop to fence with you and cannot see to his left and right.
it also sort of requires everyone to collide at the same time. Everyone has to go hard.
Right. Exactly.
Like, it's not pipe drilling.
At Culloden as well, you've shot down at least most of the front ranks, so they're going to be arriving in dribs and drabs as well. So it's... Which guy do I have to
say? That scene at the first Lord of the Rings movie with like the camera panning down the elves, and it's like beautifully synchronized. It's like, wow, it's really nice of them to coordinate their attack like that. Brilliant.
I mean, the colonel, I think it was captain of the Grenadiers of Barrel's regiment, tried to meet the first Highlander personally, and he did impale him through the throat with his spontoon. But the second Highlander then cut his head in two. And that's the other problem. Once you have stabbed your guy, there's another guy behind him. So I believe Monroe's regiment actually had the idea that the first rank uses the bayonet, and the second rank fire through over the shoulder to try and prevent
that. That could potentially highlight a slight tweak, not so much as the Bennett drill. I've not got onto it yet, but the Bennett drill at Culloden in this period is muskets held at breast height, sort of like that's why they can do that at Culloden and kind of hold them at bay. Mm-hmm. And then by the Revolution, I think it's the 1760s, they switch what we're familiar with today in the Napoleonic period, where the musket is held down at stomach height, kind of angled upwards with the bayonet, because it's more natural that way.
Yeah, it is. It's the early pike drill is like but it is like a pike.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But if you look at the English Civil War diagrams, the way they the order to charge your pike is exactly the same as charge your bayonet. And it's Wolfe, I think, that adopts the waist-high position. And although the French, we should say, have already been using waist-high bayonet posture for quite a while.
They favour the bayonet anyway. And it's interesting, indeed. There's there's an account from, I can't remember the name of it, but he's a Drake. The book's called Amiable Renegade, and basically he goes around enlisting in regiments, deserting, getting arrested, and re-enlisting. It's a great book. But in that, he puts, he says that anyone who trains at the pike is sort of more masculine. They're the creme de la creme. They're like the elite, manly soldier, whereas these newfangled guns are just, they're not really, you know, worth anything or anything like that. So
it will never catch on. It's just a fad.
Yeah, exactly. It's like an internet thing. So it's interesting how like the martial element of the pike sort of carries on even when it's entering redundancy. Mm-hmm. I suppose redundancy in the British service, if you look at Sweden, it's a different story. But.
And Russia and stuff like that. But is it Turenne or de Saxe who writes about the effectiveness of musketry as being, well, it doesn't kill anybody kind of thing?
Yeah.
There's a really interesting debate during the period about people, sort of like the national identity of armies and how they vary depending on what nation. So you have, again, a little bit further forward, but the idea of firepower being the most important thing in the battlefield is sort of very Prussian. And then the idea of hand-to-hand engagements, close combat, is quite French. They're, you know, Elan, the French rush in with the bayonet, and that's how they win. Interesting, the French trying to actually combat that mindset during the American Revolutionary period, where there's a big debate within France between French commanders as to whether they can betray their national psyche and become Prussianized, in this classic French idea. I'm not really sure what you could say where Britain fits into that. I think there is a lot of interest in firepower, but it sways backwards and forwards. I mean, the Revolution, it's much more combat-based, which we'll probably talk about later.
Okay. That links in kind of... Maybe Dorman, can you tell us what is the British soldier like at the time then? So we're not doing conscripts at this stage. What is the character? We don't have a lot of Irish, legally. But... you know, let's talk crime rates, let's talk ill discipline or discipline. What are they like? Give us a flavour of them. Because this is really your bag.
Yeah, so your average soldier is probably about 5'6", 5'7", brown hair, and most likely called John, if you want, based on my sample study, which was about... I take that back. If he's a deserter, he's likely to be called John, because that's where a lot of my information comes from.
John's a full coward.
Yeah, I think you're looking at around, if you want, I suppose, a national percentage, you're probably maybe 30% Irish at any given point. Scottish, it's difficult to quantify because they have sort of more homogenous regiments of Scots that there will be scattered throughout the others as well, but they're more concentrated. He's not a particularly pleasant person. Society doesn't view them particularly favourably either. Essentially, yeah. They're kind of there's a juvenility to them, if I can say that. It's they're kind of viewed as like childish almost, because not that they're playing dress up, but because of the niceties of discipline and the fact that they can't take wives and anything like that. There's a perceived, again, lack of masculinity to the army, which is kind of surprising from what you might expect sort of today, where it's like hyper-masculine. They're all big fans of the drink, has to be said, particularly in Ireland. There's a great diary. I've talked about this before, I think, but it's just after the American War of Independence, and it's a surgeon who's in Ireland, and he's trying to figure out why all these soldiers based in Ireland have terrible sores on their legs, and he figures out, oh, it's from the whiskey. And there's a soldier who has the surgery done, and it takes weeks for this surgery, and he's lancing the things and everything like this. It takes ages, and then immediately afterwards he goes back to the pub and ruins all the hard work that's been done. And the surgeon himself writes and just says, yeah, he undid all my work in an hour, but it had taken me 3 weeks. So you've got a fairly alcoholic service. And then I suppose in their off-duty time, it depends very much on where they're based. If you're in the West Indies, you're probably dying of plague. That's a bit facetious, but it West Indies is kind of the worst
it's
place.
True.
It's the worst place you could be sent. Gibraltar, you're dying of boredom. And then I suppose if you're in the British Isles, you've got a very different experience if you're based in Scotland versus Ireland versus England. Ireland at this point has the largest number of sort of soldiers on payroll at any given point, anywhere between 12 to 16,000. Now this fluctuates throughout the period, but they are consistent in that period. They're housed in barracks in Ireland. In England, they're housed with the people sometimes, but in Ireland that was deemed to be a terrible idea. Separate the army from the people. Don't let them get infected with Catholicism or anything like that. So you have regiments scattered throughout the countryside as well, because there's an element of mass suppression to it. So you'll have your regiments broken up by companies. So you'll have a couple of dragoon companies over here, and then a couple more over here, and then the majority will be based in Dublin, and they'll only come together for parades and the like. There is issues with desertion. There is issues with, as I mentioned, mutiny. So it's not a particularly glorious force. It's not what's often assumed when you look at, I guess, Wellington's army. Well, Zach might disagree regarding discipline. But it's there's no real one character to it. It very much depends on where you are. And I think it's unfair to assume a single character to it. But the individual soldier is not a particularly pleasant person. He probably drinks a lot. Unlikely to have a family. If he does, great. If he doesn't, whatever. And the issue of religion is also an interesting one. Likely to be fairly religious, but also there's a degree of cynicism to it. And there's one account from a Methodist soldier who he's basically bullied for his religion because he's seen as just this outcast. So there's an element of that to it too. So there's a lot going on, basically.
Were they banned from being Catholic?
It depends how devout you want to be. If you have to declare your allegiance to the head of the Church of England, who is obviously the king. So if you do that, or queen. So if you do that, you're renouncing the Pope.
Right.
So if you were willing to take that step away from your faith, you could get in. And also if you pretended not to be Irish.
I'm going to say, and you're saying there's like no Irish, and then you're going, well, actually 30% of them are still Irish.
Yeah.
Really easy to lie.
Well, that statistic comes from post... I take that back. That's 1730s, 1740s. And then it gets higher post-1760s. After the Seven Years' War, they realise, we actually have quite a lot of manpower here. So maybe we'll allow periods of Irish recruitment. And that's where you have things like the Inniskillings copping up, who obviously have quite a high percentage of Protestants. They're very well-behaved. Before they go off to America, I've got the accounts of their drills and everything, and these guys are very good. They're very good soldiers, very well disciplined, and well, I don't know how they do in America, but at least they start off strong.
Fascinating. That's really interesting. I mean, there's some of the same old troubles. I mean, the British Army even today is a bit of a problem with alcoholism, and it's only now being kind of brought out that maybe drinking yourself until you get naked and is sick every Friday night is possibly not a healthy culture for a career. I'm actually kind of serious on that. And then are they unpleasant? Well, yeah, because you're recruiting them to kill other people, which is a particularly unpleasant career path. But it's the same old troubles, but it sounds like the discipline's maybe not there in the same way that later that they might be let off the leash and then come back on.
Recruitment's actually, I don't know if it differs too much. You can jump in on the Napoleonic section. But you have a beating up party who goes around and recruits people. That's the official way to do it. But there's a lot of unofficial ways to recruit people, too. Getting them drunk and forcing them to sign the King's Shilling afterwards. Yep. Abducting people, sometimes. There's a great story of a guy who's enlisted. I think this might be in Scotland. And then the town rises up in arms, goes to the beating party, kicks the crap out of them, if you'll pardon the term, steals your man back and takes them back home. So there's a little bit of pushback, but there isn't obviously conscription. It's a volunteer service. And there's a strong discourse in this officer called Dalrymple writes this discourse on how to improve the army. And he says that if you take volunteers, they can turn into good soldiers. If you press them into service, they're the scum of the earth and the refuse of mankind. So that is the discrepancy. And there's a recognition of that.
Before Wellington said it.
Yeah. So do not conscript people. They will not be good soldiers.
And you said they did have conscription for brief periods.
I suppose there are press.
They're just beating up so many people and taking them. It's basically conscription anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's periods where their press acts are put in place where you're told, you know, let's have a serious recruitment here, chaps. And they do, I suppose, bend the rules a little bit. But in terms of your average totting up of the regiments that will happen throughout the century, it's volunteer.
Okay. So it's a bit different to the modern sponsored YouTube adverts that you might now see to join the army.
Yeah, exactly. And the recruits themselves are often vetted. So there's a distinction between recruit and, or hang on, how did it, enlisted and recruit, I guess, if you know what I mean. As in, just because the recruiting party grabbed you doesn't necessarily mean you'll end up in the ranks. You're not going to be fit for service for quite some time. So that distinction is made, particularly coming into the 1770s.
Yeah, I mean, we recorded earlier one of my favourite Sharp unions, which is Sharp's regiment, and you have that where the doctor kind of cast a brief eye over all of them and then gets slipped a guinea and signs them all off as being fit. And it's kind of like, well, the doctor's inspected them.
Back in Marlborough's day, there was a contemporary play called The Recruiting Sergeant, which was written by a chap called Lieutenant Farquhar of a Grenadier Company or something like that. And I have a little excerpt from it here, which kind of lays out what they were looking for. And, you know, quote, "If any gentlemen, soldiers, or others have a mind to serve Her Majesty and pull down the French king, if any prentices have severe masters, any children undutiful parents, if any servants have too little wages, or any husband too much wife, let him repair to the noble Sergeant Kite at the sign of the Raven in this good town of Shrewsbury, where he shall receive present relief and entertainment."
I'd do it. Yeah. I would.
So you're looking for people who are out of work and bored.
Yeah.
And they can give them work and boredom anyway. As you're saying, going to places and seeing the world and then getting bored in barracks. Yeah, it doesn't always lead to good discipline. I think what we'll do is we'll circle back and come to the ill discipline, especially in Ireland, because I think I want to let Dorman kind of go off the leash.
Go mad.
Something you mentioned is that like people like the Inniskillings, you know, great regiments, until they went to America. And we can't do like the full thing with America because I've done that with Robbie recently. But what I want to know is, Robbie, can you give us like a little bit of background on the conflict and the behaviours of the British Army, maybe, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, I mean, Revolutionary War comes about. Wait, are we talking the Revolution or the Seven Years' War?
let's do the Revolution, though, and we're going to have to circle back to Wolf because I think we all love Wolf a little bit. So.
Right, yeah. But yeah, I mean, the Revolutionary War comes out of the imperial crisis of the sort of late 1760s. Basically, most people know the story. It's a dispute between Great Britain and her 13 North American colonies over issues of taxation and representation. And it all boils over. The army is already there, but more are deployed. And we get fully-fledged conflict between Great Britain, her allies, and the American colonists and their allies after 1778. So that's essentially the root of the conflict. The army at the start of the war is not especially well prepared for it. They're in an interesting place in so much as senior officers do have reasonable combat experience because most of them are in the Seven Years' War. As junior officers, they carry a lot of the knowledge they gained from that conflict over into the revolution. Having said that, the actual sort of rank and file, for the most part, don't have a great deal of specific combat experience. It's not to say that they have none at all during this period. There's a lot of unrest in the UK. I mean, it's Georgian Britain. There's unrest all the time. You get events similar to the infamous Boston Massacre in 1770. They're not even that uncommon in Britain. You have the army opening fire at crowds at Spitalfield, at St. George's Fields, places like this. There's a lot of anti-smuggling operations in the UK. There's obviously the whole Irish dimension. There's a small war in the Caribbean. I think it's a slave uprising. Can't remember which island though. So they're not wholly inexperienced, but for the most part, they haven't seen action when fighting starts in 1775. There's an interesting study that claims, I can't remember offhand who did it, but it claims that actually the American or the Patriot militia at Lexington and Concord had more combat experience due to people having been in the Seven Years' War than the actual regulars that they fought on that day, which kind of turns on the heads the whole idea that the British Army in this period is the best in the world and they're just going to stomp over the Americans, and actually it's a big underdog story. The British Army in 1775 is kind of a bit iffy, and it takes a lot of hard lessons to become competent.
Yeah. If I can jump in up until 1770, it was tradition for the regiments in Ireland to be a lot smaller. Reason being that if they were smaller, you can just fill them up really rapidly when you need them and then ship them further afield. However, in 1770, they decide, let's expand these regiments out and bring them up to full size. So you have a massive recruitment drive for something like 20, I think it is about 20 regiments who are based in Ireland at that point, all of which are desperate for recruits and will take basically anyone, which might explain 5 years down the line why a lot of them are lacking combat experience. Okay, they might be built around a cadre of officers, sure, as you mentioned, but most of the rank and file would have just been scraped very recently from the bottom of the barrel. So you've got regiments coming back from the Caribbean basically being glued back together as well. So it's a stent. I think it's not spent, but recently restocked, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think there is an understanding that that is an issue early on in the war. And part of the reason that Britain struggles with numbers in America, well, I mean, it's the reason they hire Hessians, I never say it right. I say Hessians for some reason. Most people say Hessians. Whatever.
We say Hessians because of Sleepy Hollow, don't we, really?
Let's go with that. So Hessians, German state forces that are allied to Britain contractually. Britain has to hire them because there is a manpower shortage because they realize if they rush troops into battle in the Americas, they're going to have a bad time. So it takes at least 2 years of training to bring a soldier sort of up to the standard that they believe is required for fighting in America. So if you've got soldiers being going into the army in 75, 76 is sort of the big push for recruits, they're not able to take the field until 78, 79, which is why you have manpower shortages, really.
And what's the way of getting over manpower shortages? Is that, say, specifically in America, are they, you know, the Hessians, are they just basically hiring mercenaries? Are they recruiting locally? Well, something we never really hear much about.
Yeah,
it's the loyalists, the people that didn't want the revolutionary.
I mean, the first answer to how do they get over the manpower shortage, they don't, and that's why they lose the war. But, there's a lot of interesting things that the government does. The Hessians are a good place to start because any sort of person that studies the Crown forces in the revolution will get a bit prickly when you call Hessians mercenaries, because that was the propaganda line taken by the patriots, the revolutionaries, and was very effective. But technically, it stretches the definition of a mercenary. So if you think of a mercenary soldier,
they're not Hanoverian. At the time, the Crown is in a personal union with Hanover, so they're not like the King's German Legion, are they?
Well, there were some. So this is a whole other topic, but we call it Hessian. In reality, there were six different German states that provided troops, I think. Hanover was one of them, but the Hanoverian regiments weren't sent to America. They helped garrison Gibraltar, I think, and that sort of area. So Hessian is a catch-all phrase because most of them, well, actually just under a majority, so not even most of them, many of them were from the German state of Hesse-Cassel. Nice. But there were Brunswick, the other Hesse, there were two.
Now.
Thank you very much. Waldeck. Mm. I'm not going to be able to name all of them. I think I'm missing one, but yeah.
We're going catch, or we're calling them a Hessian because we're lazy. Exactly. And it's a bit like calling them all German, and then actually some of them are technically from Poland later on, and all that kind of, the borders change. Okay.
Troops like this have been called Hessians since the 1740s. Troops moved to, some were hired to fight in Scotland in 1745, and they were also called Hessians. They fought at Blenheim, and they were called Hessians. It's a common thing.
Hesse-Cassel actually made the idea of hiring its army out a thing. Like, they created a pre-made army package with, like, a cavalry regiment and some artillery and some, like, infantry, and any country could hire these guys to go and fight in their war, which is where you get the kind of the misapprehension that they're mercenaries. So I think sort of the idea of a mercenary soldier or a band of mercenary soldiers is their guys, and you pay them and they fight for you. It doesn't matter who you are. If you pay them, they fight for you. The Hessians were fighting for their landgrave, their prince, their monarch. They were fighting for their country. It just so happens that their monarch was allied to Britain because he was getting paid a lot of money. So
it's a little bit more political. I mean,
yeah, it's not really.
It's some Swiss regiments that they, you even see like loyalist Russians and loyalist French in the later areas, and they move around different nationalities, but that's because the politics change and then they get paid, but they're getting paid. Okay.
A Hessian regiment, each soldier's getting paid by Britain and they go and fight for Britain. It's their standing army, and their monarch says, you're going to go and fight for the British because we're allied to the British because the British are paying me loads of money.
So they're not a mercenary.
It's another form of alliance. It's a bit dodgy, but it's not crazy. The other manpower shortages, just briefly skipping over it, and there's actually quite a lot of recruitment, not a lot, but there's interesting recruitment into the regular British forces from Europe. So it's estimated about 10% of British regulars in the Revolution were not British-born. So there were Dutch, a lot of different German states. So you actually had occasionally recruiting parties would go to German states and recruit directly, which is kind of weird because you think the Germans fighting alongside the British are the Hessians and the Hessian regiments. But there are some red-coated British regulars who are actually of German descent. There's a story of one Dutch guy who had a terrible time because he did not understand any English at all. And, he did not get on well with his regiment. So they're so desperate for manpower, they are just bringing in some Europeans to sort of bolster the ranks. You have, I can't remember the year, but at some point during the Revolutionary War, they very much relaxed the idea that Catholics can't join the army because then they can get French Canadians, who are mostly Catholic, kind of on side to make sure that they don't join the revolutionaries. And you have the loyalists, which I feel like I'm just totally separate subjects. But yeah, Americans who are pro the British for whatever reason, and they can either be recruited directly into regular regiments in the standing army. They can join the provincial corps, which is essentially like the colonial version of the standing army. So they're still professional soldiers, but they're in loyalist all units. And then you get volunteer loyalist militias, which are just the same as the revolutionary ones, but on the other side. So it's a big hodgepodge.
It's a huge hodgepodge for that. I mean, I know that, especially for the listeners, we covered this in quite a lot of depth about the light infantry. And if anyone hasn't heard that, I encourage at the end of this, you go back and listen to Robbie's one. The cartoon that Steve did is fantastic hats. And we talked a lot about hats, didn't we? But this is where we also get some other stuff. I don't think we talked about the Rangers very much in that. Actually, we talked about like the British light infantry. And are the Rangers British? Are they loyalists? Are they a mixed match? Because especially Robert's Rangers come in massively into this. But he's not the only one doing it. But where do they sit in the scheme?
So they are, the origins, as you point out, they're with Robert Rogers during the Seven Years' War, French and Indian War, if you're American. So very famously, they are American colonists who adopt the Native American style of warfare, very irregular, ranging, literally. They're expected to be able to cover vast distances and mount raids and attack in unexpected places, and they fight in forests and all that sort of stereotypes that we think of the American style of warfare. They're sort of the go-to guys for that. They teach the British a lot. They actually have like a ranger school that Roger sets up where he takes officers from the regular army and teaches them how to range. And then they disseminate that knowledge back to their regiments. In the Revolution, it's a little bit different. Robert Rogers is an alcoholic and is really past his best by the time the Revolution kicks off. He tries to join the Continental Army. George Washington is like, we don't want you. He goes to the British. They take him on. He forms a ranger regiment, the Queen's Rangers, but they're not very effective because he's past it. And eventually he's sort of shimmied off. Don't know what happens to him. Can't remember. Ends up at a dead end in Britain. That might be before or after the Revolution. I can't remember. But the Queen's Rangers are then taken over by a British officer, John Grey of Simcoe, who reforms them and makes them a very effective loyalist American group. It's kind of weird because the regiment, it's a legion. So basically a legion in this period is a regiment that contains infantry and cavalry, sometimes light artillery. So Rogers, Simcoe, even though it's just one regiment, he has hussars, he has a rifle company. He has a Highland company for some reason that is just Highland Scots. But
it's cool to have one.
Yeah, exactly. And it means that we can debate endlessly as to whether they had kilts or not, because we don't know.
The Royal Highland Immigrants.
Yeah. he's kind of like this sort of catch-all unit of the Queen's Rangers that were very effective. I will argue fiercely with people as to whether they were the most effective Loyalist provincial corps unit or whether it was the British Legion. But that's a different thing.
For another time, maybe.
And then there's Butler's Tory Rangers.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah.
Were very much more like what Robert Rogers' Rangers were, and they fought with the Iroquois on the northern frontier.
As we've said, you know, we mentioned the other podcast as well, but Ferguson, you've got a rifle company there, and this is now actually where I start to get excited, because it's changing technology and changing doctrine, not just because of the rifles and Sean Bean, and I'm a reenactor. But genuinely, it's cool because it's development. We're actually moving forward. You said there's a ranger school. I mean, that's a standing school aside from at a depot doing drill. Tactics, development, things are changing. People are thinking. People are being trained to use their brain. And I think it's quite cool.
It is the Ranger School is the Seven Years' War, and then they promptly forget it all and have to relearn it in the Revolution. And then they forget it again and have to relearn it in the Napoleonic Wars.
If you want a theme for this episode of the British Army, it's the British Army learning something, immediately forgetting it, having to relearn it, doing a bit better, then forgetting it again, and then doing the same thing over again.
Fair enough. That, I'm trying to think of what that's the equivalent to, like teaching me maths, algebra at school. Like, you can explain that to me as many times as you want, Mr. Jenkins, but I'm just not getting why A and B and C are going to be up there when you put a power to them. I'm just like, what? You teach me one day, I get it. 2 days later, don't. It does seem like a goldfish kind of moment that we're getting somewhere, especially with Robert Rogers, and then it goes back down, and it seems bizarre that you can almost trace Robert Rogers to like experimental rifle corps, the 95th, and actually there isn't really that connection because it keeps dropping out each time, and there's not a pathway between them.
It's very much to do with like specific conflicts as well. The reason they gave Rogers the time of day was because they were getting their butts kicked by the French and Canadian forces who were pretty much using Native American tactics to contain British incursions into the Ohio and into Canada, and they had nothing to deal with it. So it's another case of the British rise to the challenge of adapting and then decide, well, we don't need that anymore.
And there's something to be said as well for just the way knowledge and information was disseminated in the 18th century versus the way we think of it today. You know, you think of today, the army has to train people and there's manuals and it's taught and it's just done like this and it's all written down. Whereas in the 18th century, it's just sort of disseminated through people talking, conversing, sharing ideas, but not necessarily all referring back to like a single manual. There's probably stuff that can be said in there about how, you know, it's without going overboard, there's the officer class and they run the show and there's these ideas that they bounce because they know each other fraternally and they sort of share ideas and thoughts and concepts and they philosophize about it. but they don't necessarily sit down and have like a big committee meeting where they say this is what the army is now going to do until sort of the Napoleonic period, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I guess that's when they do put things down. So Sir John Moore, and actually he taught a lot of his stuff by Germans who know light infantry stuff. So it is kind of connected there. I think what we're not going to be able to touch on is actually the Germans managed to keep up the light infantry, the rifles, and those kind of really niche tactics of skirmishing and ranging up much better because of their constant fighting throughout. Their soldiers kind of stay in and keep this professional soldiery in. So is there much that we're taking away from the American Revolutionary War, or is it 90% plus kind of being, right, we've lost, tails between our legs, coming home, and we're going to forget our lessons?
There's a bit of enforced forgetting, shall we say, because after the revolution, you have a bit of a conflict within the hierarchy of the army, fighting for the soul of the army, more or less. There's a theory among British high commands that the tactics employed in America would not work in Europe. That, you know, this more sort of light type of warfare, more skirmishy, wouldn't work if you come up against a solid wedge of, say, a French column or something like that. It's an interesting debate because there were times when the British actually did encounter the French in the Revolution. There's a battle in the Caribbean at the Vieux Peninsula where they completely decimate four French columns, partly using light infantry tactics, partly because there's loads of Royal Artillery 18-pounders firing as well, which helps. But there's a bit of back and forth about that. But generally, the army hierarchy fears that North America isn't applicable when it comes to Europe, and they're expecting to fight a European war at this point. So they go down, same with the French to an extent, they go down the Prussianization route, where it becomes about drill discipline, platoon firing, tight close order ranks, all that sort of stuff, which is where you are kind of at when the French Revolution kicks off.
Okay, thank you. So I think that ties in nicely. The army's coming back, and where a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it's going is Ireland. Is that right?
Yeah.
Dance, because that's just not helping anyone. But yeah, he's doing a little jig, and that's making me laugh. But yeah, they're coming back, and I mean, considerably, I presume a lot of them are going to Scotland, with the Jacobite threats not ever really kind of gone away 100%. There's a lot going to end up in Gibraltar. The great siege of Gibraltar is kind of on the horizon, which is a great one, maybe for another time. Gibraltar is a fantastic siege and case study of kind of pig-headed stubbornness, really. And some
weird cannons.
Yeah, weird downward firing cannons, caves, defences. I love Gibraltar. I really do, both as a holiday destination and a historical study. But that does link us on to Ireland. So, Dorman, the army when it comes back, is it different to the army that went away as a starting point?
Right. So, as I mentioned, there was that big recruitment drive and there was the change in doctrine in Ireland. So, but to understand what, not what prompted it, but perhaps why this is such an important moment, you need to jump back a little bit further, because the relationship of the army and the civilian in Ireland is rocky, I think would be a nice way of putting it. And in the over the course of the 1760s, things hadn't really been going particularly well. And there might have been an element of, well, if we can increase the size of the army, we might actually improve repression as well. But with the loss of so many regiments to America, and you're talking almost, I think, 50% of the garrison. You have a garrison that's very much spread quite thin, who has quite a bad reputation anyway. And whether it's perhaps guilt from not being able to take part, or perhaps there's a survivor thing going on, who knows. The army is misbehaving whilst it is in Ireland. And there's also this rising threat of a French invasion. And as a result of this, you have the foundation of the Irish Volunteers. And these are initially set up by very wealthy Protestant nobles. Nobles is such a medieval term for it. Business, what have you, magnates. And that's almost more medieval. I'm killing this here. But anyway, so the wealthy Protestants set up these groups, and they're formed around like gentlemen's clubs and that kind of thing. And they're set up to at first to show loyalty and also ostensibly to protect against French invasion. But what happens is you have these volunteer movements. They seem to supplant the army in a lot of the civil policing roles. So you have the volunteers chasing after criminals. You have the volunteers putting down riots peacefully, not opening fire, this kind of thing. And this coincides, again, with a massive protest movement in Dublin specifically, but it's dotted around the country as well, known as hawking. Now, hawking is essentially an attack by the butchers in the city against the soldiers, where they would terrorize them. They would ambush them in the streets at night and deliberately slash the back of their legs on the calves to maim them to the point where they couldn't march again. And this is systematic. So it kicks off at the start of the American War of Independence, and it fluctuates with army behavior. So if the army's misbehaving, hawking increases. It's like a cyclical sort of phenomenon. And there's a massive spike in it later on in 1784, where the army tries to break some soldiers out of prison, which isn't a good look for any organization. And then there's an incident where they try to deploy the army against a barman who happens to insult some officers and drive them out of his bar. So all of these incidents coincide with a rise in this sort of essentially organized, like, terror group against the soldiers, I suppose, if you want to use that term. Maybe it's a bit too political. But it's a very hostile sort of workplace relationship. And the volunteers are just seen as this alternative. So the British Army is becoming incredibly unpopular. And the fact that it in any way recovers from this coming into the 1790s is nothing short of a miracle. It's no surprise, really, that it performed so poorly, at least at first in 1798, because that period is obviously not great for the British military either. But across the American War of Independence, the army at home is in, I think it's fair to say, kind of a shambles. And it doesn't, it's not surprising that they are performing, they're mutually symbiotic, I suppose. Bad performance there, bad performance here, crisis of conscience, crisis of masculinity as well, replacement service being present with the volunteers. It's a bad time all around.
Can I just out of interest ask, what was the, if you know, what was the attitude between the army and the volunteers? Were they like antagonistic?
Yeah, so I mentioned that bar fight. The barman was a volunteer. So these officers go in and they're drunk and they start harassing his wife. And he says, step away from my wife. Come on, you're supposed to be honorable. And they notice he's got a little volunteer symbol on his chest. So they go, oh, you're a volunteer, are you? And then they tweak his nose. Exact quote. So he goes, okay, that's enough. He punches one of them in the face, then goes back behind his bar and takes out his musket. So the officers are driven out into the street. They come back very apologetically saying, we're sorry, we're sorry, we're sorry. Psych, grab his musket, throw it into the River Liffey. Then some bystanders, having seen this, start to rally against the officers, and they start pelting them with stones. So these very drunken officers then sprint back to the barracks and try to turn out the garrison to attack this bar and mob. Okay. So it's a massive PR crisis for the army, because you can't have officers acting like this. It's just embarrassing. And there's a newspaper called the Hibernian Journal, or the Chronicle of Liberty, depending on which you want to name you want to take. And they are constantly undermining the army and triumphing the volunteers. There is some cooperation between them. So particularly in riot suppression, they welcome the help. And this is also a period where you've got a lot of agricultural protest. Particularly there's a protest movement called the Right Boys, who have these massive, you're talking 2,000 strong groups who just sort of roam the countryside. They're advocating for things like tithes. There's very few deaths, but there's a lot of sort of destruction of property. And the volunteers help suppress those, as well as the army in cooperation with them. So those sort of civil policing duties are shared, and that's something of a relief, but there's a sense of you're replacing us. So there's definitely, it's not a happy relationship.
Right, yeah. It's just really fascinating. Sorry, I won't labour the point. But the similarities between, because I know nothing about Ireland, sorry.
That's fine. No.
The similarities between the British Army situation in Ireland and its situation in Boston in sort of 1770, late 1760s, where you've got the regulars and locals basically having like gang fights with each other and all sorts of little flashpoints. There's also the Sons of Liberty so-called with their journal of occurrences, where they document everything bad the army does and spread it around and sort of help stir up the rebellion. So really interesting crossovers there.
Yeah, and there's one thing I'm sort of hypothesizing in my own head for one of the sections of my thesis is that the army is, particularly in the 1740s, 50s, is just another gang. There are two main gangs in Dublin. One is full of butchers called the Ormond Boys, and the other is full of weavers called the Liberty Boys. And then there's the army, and it's just them playing off one another for most of that decade. The army eventually just makes a complete hames of suppressing that. It's a disaster. What they do is they're told, go in and destroy the weavers' markets because they're clandestine and they're operating illegally, so take those out. But at the same time, they parade the whole military and tell them, do not participate in any riots whatsoever. Don't suppress them, don't join them, do nothing. So they destroy these weavers' markets and then just go back home. So there's a colossal riot as a result of this, which kind of, again, ruins army-civilian relationships for the next 10 years.
I can't imagine that happening at any other point in Irish history, that the army kicks off and then does nothing.
Mm-hmm. No.
It's really interesting that you actually say that, because I've done two YouTube videos where I basically, where myself and my co-host pretty much decide that the British Army in Boston in 1775 are pretty much acting just like a gang defending its own turf against the Sons of Liberty and the Boston population. It's a fairly common thing to happen.
It's a tale older than time. There's a lot to be said about recent conflicts. Iraq, there was the Sunni Shias and the British, and it was just all three just taking lumps out of each other. And I think the army's very bad at that. And I quite like the tweaking the nose. I was listening very recently to Eamon O'Keefe, a PhD candidate, who did. And the tweaking nose was a real honour thing. It was actually like shaming somebody. And then lastly, my comment is, the poor territorial army. No one likes that. it's older than time.
I think one of the issues with the gang thing is that there's no doctrine. This is pre-Gordon riots. 1784 isn't, but most of this is pre-Gordon riots. So there isn't that really shameful incident where everything goes really wrong and we need to do something. And also in Ireland, there's no Mutiny Act either. So there's a lot of... And there's no Riot Act. And there isn't a Riot Act until 1780?
And the Riot Act's really important because they would literally read it out loud and tell people to disperse, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and it then gives the soldiers a clear conscience to do whatever they need to do afterwards.
I guess like whatever the step off of the ASBO was, where they used to try to do it to public disorder.
Yeah, it's a mass dispersal tactic, but that there isn't one of them to read out in Ireland. And because it's the Irish establishment which is being paid for by the Irish government and is a separate entity in itself, it needs this legislation to be passed by the Irish Parliament, who are very anti-military and want nothing to do with it. So they never are given the administrative support to do their jobs, yet 90% of what they do is the jobs that need that administrative support. So I'm not defending what they do, because they put down riots like a sledgehammer. It's ridiculous. But at the same time, it's interesting that they lack that admin to actually do what they need to
do. But they don't have the tools to do the job adequately, is what you're kind of saying. It's not an excuse for behaviour, but there's a reason that they're behaving so badly.
And there does seem to be an escalation protocol that they have in place. There's one riot in particular where this one just stands out because it's a woman who's doing most of the agitating. So there's a party of soldiers who are trying to put down these guys, and they point their guns at them, and a woman in the background is saying, they have no powder, they have no powder, don't worry about it. So then they fire blanks, or they fire just powder, and they say, they've got no ball, it's fine, they've got no ammunition. So then they fire at the shop signs above them, and then she said, they'll never shoot at us, and then they volley fire into the crowd. So there it does seem to be, a trend of like, we will eventually escalate this if you do not disperse. But there's no set system. It's very much the call of whoever's in charge. And that could be the mayor or it could be an officer, because the soldiers are assigned to civil authorities.
Very similar to the Boston Massacre. Although the Boston Massacre was in a smaller amount of men, they were egged on to eventually In fact, no order was given. That was ill-discipline, like Robbie was saying in the garrisons in America, that someone just eventually lost his temper and fired, and the rest of them all fired because they thought the officer had given the order.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Yeah, so, I mean, that's why discipline is so important, is what we're coming back to. And if they're not being trained to independently think, then it has repercussions. And if they don't have the, you know, the tools to do the job and the legal framework, it's going to cause a huge problem. Where do we end up at the end of the century? By the 1780s and 1790s, are we in a better state than at the beginning?
Flanders would imply not.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of, like, I know this is obviously a podcast that has three guys going, no.
I think the commission system, it just kind of has rendered everything broken. I mean, you've got an officer corps who just don't know what they're doing, and you've got automatons for soldiers who have no independent action at all, really, or know how to go about what they're doing. And, I mean, there's no surprise that the Grand Old Duke of York marches his men up and down the hill.
The Duke of York can be credited with influencing a great many reforms that allow the army to move into conflict better against Napoleon. He's influenced by officers who've served in America and officers who have studied in Germany and things like that. Which is where you get Dundas and the drill book and things like that, and the flight infantry school and things. And that's a collision of the German and American schools, if you will, because there was a tension at the end of the century between those who had fought in America, who believed in the, in quotes, American scramble version of the way to do things. And that included line infantry, because by the end of the American War, line infantry battalions were able to extend into open order and do stuff. But, you know, I agree. I personally agree. It was not in good shape to face a dynamic offensive army like the one that it faced in Flanders, fielded by the Republic of France.
I really want one day there to be some sort of like revisionist movement that say that actually this was great. But at the moment, I think we can safely say, yeah, the 1790s British Army was not at top notch. I mean, I don't know if there's, it's not my period, but I kind of feel instinctively like there's parallels between the Boer War and the First World War, between 1790s and the Peninsula War, maybe a little bit. Maybe I'm just picking that up. I don't know.
I mean, as with all things, it depends a great deal on the general. The British Army does have the advantage of it. It will perform well if you have a general who knows how to make it perform well, and it could be tailored in on campaign to do stuff, but it couldn't be brought into the campaign by a dunderhead and be expected to outperform the enemy.
And sadly, we see quite a lot of those kind of characters at this time, don't we?
Like Cumberland.
Yeah. He only won one battle, and that battle is not allowed as a battle owner.
Is there any redeeming features, any branches that we see changing? What we have not talked about is the Royal Regiment, artillery, themselves, God's Own Gunners, obviously very close to my heart. Do they seem any kind of reform between Blenheim and the kind of after the American Revolution? Do they improve? Josh is nodding. Josh, what happens with the gunners?
Well, I also see Robbie trying to form words.
I was just going to fire in a crappy joke. I was going to say that we can technically not talk about them because they're not part of the army in this period.
I was
going
to say.
We can get all the way into 18th century semantics and talk about the Board of Ordnance.
Yeah. We,
they are technically part of the Board of Ordnance, not part of the...
Yeah. There is also the Royal Irish Artillery, which is separate as well. It's its own little thing.
They are. There are companies of Irish artillery. Yes.
Bearing in mind that it's not technically part of the army, and that's a big pain in the neck, and one of the reasons why the British Army is in kind of a state when Wellington gets to command in Spain. But why don't we just say that, actually, if we circle way back to Marlborough, one of the reforms he did make when he was Master General of the Ordnance at one point, or he, Commander-in-Chief, he did actually try to reform the artillery, which at that, when he was serving on the continent, was a rather bulky and clunky thing, and he formed it into two artillery companies. And from there, it sort of slowly grinds on doing its thing, as it always has, supporting the army, providing the artillery, you know, providing the big guns. And it supplies the standout field piece for the British Army, which is the brass 9-pounder, which sees service from about 1719 all the way into the Peninsular War. And it's actually brought back into service in the Peninsular War because it falls out of favor at a certain point. But if you're going to actually look at it as a part of the, in quotes, army, armed forces, that does see a certain amount of improvement. The artillery does make consistent efforts to improve its guns. It's a meritocracy largely, so you have to be you have to know what you're doing to become a officer. You have to pass the school.
They've been to Woolwich, I believe.
Yeah,
they've done some training.
Yeah, you can't buy a commission to be in the Royal Artillery. Patronage is still a thing, absolutely, but you do have to actually pass. Exactly.
I mean, that's never going to happen. Britain was built on nepotism, basically. But yeah, there is a degree of training there, and obviously, I'm declaring my interest, my bias of being a gunner. But it is interesting to hear that they do slowly make some improvements. Do they have doctrine books a bit earlier than the infantry then? Because it's the technical branch.
They do. I mean, it's not fair to say completely that the infantry had no doctrine books. It's just they had a lot of them.
Lots of different.
And usually they appeared during wars, or when wars were going to happen. With the artillery, you get people like what's his name?
Crawford.
I'm thinking of. I think it was. I have it written down actually somewhere. John Mueller, who was the master gunner of Woolwich and author of the Treaties of Artillery in 1768, and before him General John Armstrong, who kind of surveyed the artillery in the 1730s and found that there was a ridiculous amount of calibers of guns being used and that they needed to be simplified.
Okay. Yes, sensible reform. If you have less variation, then you've got easier logistics and, you know, simple terms, the cannonball you want fits down the gun you want. Makes a lot of sense to me. Okay, I think we're, just before we wrap up, if we can go around the room, I'm going to do two circles. What do you think was the most influential event, either, you know, innovation or battle, and then the most innovative and, like, biggest impression left by an individual, which, you know, let's not beat you around the bush, is likely to be a white European man, but that's the era we're talking about. So if we do events first, we go around. Josh, do you have an event in mind that's probably the biggest influence?
Oh, good grief. event. Weirdly enough, I would probably have to say it would be the wars in America. As an event, generally speaking.
As an event, the wars in America influenced because of the infantry kind of stuff?
Yeah, as it influenced the way that the British Army were fighting at the end of the century as opposed to how it was fighting at the beginning of the century, there is a definite difference in terms of its operational, the way it did things operationally. So I would have to say, I don't know which war. I'd be tempted to say actually the one that they lost, but they can in a way be seen almost as one kind of continuous series of action technically, but I would have to say the wars in America were the biggest event for the army.
Okay. Robbie, that's often your area. Do you agree? Would you have a specific moment in time that you in mind?
I would definitely agree. I feel like the kid in the tutorial who had an answer ready and then the person in front of them said
just does that.
What am I going to say? So I'm going to twist it slightly and just focus in within the conflict in America. I think it's tempting to look at battles when the army actually started getting going and started being more effective. But I think the opening engagements at Lexington and Concord and then at Bunker Hill outside Boston really, like, shook the army because they were basically disasters. I mean, Lexington and Concord, you were very close to having militia wipe out an entire column of regular soldiers in the opening engagement of the war. Bunker Hill, huge casualties, massive officer corps casualties. So 1/8 of all British officers killed in the Revolution were killed at Bunker Hill, just that one battle.
Anyhow.
They adapt things like their uniforms and stuff later on so they don't stand out as much. So in reality, there's a myth, we spoke about it when I was on last, that Americans sniped British officers and they were so good at it. In reality, I don't think there's actually higher casualties in the Revolution than in any other periods, conflict in this period among the officers. But there is a Bunker Hill where they don't really know what they're doing. And it's just such a shambles. And you see the army learn from it. And they take it on board. And the next time the army takes the field at Long Island, it's a complete success. They nearly destroy the Continental Army just overnight, basically.
They actually learn something. Hooray!
Yeah, I mean, they forget it. But for you see very definite and clear improvements throughout the Revolutionary War after that absolute shock right at the start of it.
Brilliant.
100% agree.
That's really interesting. Dorman.
I'm gonna be that kid in the tutorial. I guess. Well, actually, I have two answers.
so I'm special.
From my own
bullying him, like,
from my own little sphere of in Ireland, I think the most important event is in 1739, where you have the first large-scale reduction of the garrison. You have 10 regiments taken out and placed in the UK and subsequently onto the West Indies. That is the first time the garrison is dropped below 12,000 men, and it coincides with a massive rise in rioting and the beginnings of the decline of the army-societal relationship, which I've gone into detail about 20 minutes ago. That is that moment where everything starts to go wrong. And
just quickly, that is a huge garrison anyway.
Yeah.
12,000 men.
Yeah, it's massive. But they take out 10 regiments of that. And when they do that, and because they do that, I think everything that happens afterwards is as a result of that. And because it's a rotational system, every regiment in the British Army will eventually spend some time in Ireland, apart from the Guards. So you do end up with every regiment being affected by that decision, having to spend time in Ireland, probably shooting at Irish civilians at some point. So from my own little biased sphere, I'm going to go for that. However, my other answer is, I think, the most important impact on sort of the way battles are fought in this entire period is probably seeing with Frederick the Great and his invasion of Silesia and the first battle he fights there, and the name of which has gone completely out of my head, and I really wish someone, probably Josh, is going to jump in here with the name of the battle where Frederick's cavalry run away and then his infantry carry the day through Prussian infantry tactics, and that inspired basically all of Europe.
Could be Rosbach and...
Earlier.
What's the other one?
Hang on. He runs away as well. It's the battle...
There's one of the ones where he leaves because he thinks he's lost, and then someone's like,
yes.
And goes back.
Yeah, it's the first battle.
Yeah, I know. It's not coming to me.
Dash it's like Myrmigan or something like that.
Yeah, it's an M. I feel it's an M.
Yeah. Mulvitz.
Yeah.
The Battle of Mulvitz. That's I think that is probably...
Pertinax is going to be so disappointed in me.
Tonight. This is it. Sorry, guys.
But yeah, I think Mulvitz, in terms of changing the way people think and the emphasis on discipline and the shock that does to the European sort of strategy generally, I think that's pretty important.
Cool. Okay. Different answers. I mean, again, not one that we knew Mulvitz, so that's an interesting choice. And then going around, I'd really like to hear, because we didn't touch on many individuals apart from Marlborough and Robert Rogers. Who were the most influential people of that century, of that era, that left an impression or at least did something, even if it was short term, and then like teaching my mum to use control, copy, paste, as she forgets it 2 days later? Who was it that kind of put a stamp and their mark on the British Army in the 1700s. Josh?
There are a number of them, and so it's rather difficult just to choose one. For my money, the character of the Duke of Marlborough doesn't really leave the army for a good deal of time. And his example of... Yeah, so his example of sort of operational mastery and his ability to work with the Continental Allies, controlling very large forces, and being the incredibly important figure he was for being a British general in charge of a coalition army, can't be too understated. It also can't be too much understated that the reputation of the British army then, you know, went into battle with during the 1740s and obviously tripped up and fell on their faces because obviously Marlborough was dead, is largely derived from the Duke of Marlborough's expertise at logistics, at caring for his soldiers, at making sure they are at peak performance. And it was at this time that European forces would realize, would take notice of wherever the British standards flew in an Allied battle line. Because obviously, as the French found out at Minden, British troops were capable of some ridiculous things on the battlefield. And I think that is owed, certainly in Europe, because it's difficult to differentiate between Europe and America. And India, in fact, actually, which is another place that the British were fighting in the 1760s and 70s and 80s. But yeah, I'm going to say Marlborough.
Yeah. I kind of thought you might. And he's justified to be in there as one of the greatest military commanders ever, let alone British. I mean, he's up there with Wellington, and I think they both kind of trounce all over Napoleon. But he's well up there, and I'm just putting my bias in every podcast. Yeah. Okay, Robbie, I feel that you might have a really different answer, though.
I was going to ask, first of all, can I get you two to fight versus classic Wellington versus Marlborough?
Ooh. Here for hours.
That's episode two, Robbie. That's episode two.
Richard Holmes on the go here.
Oh, the great Richard Holmes. Yeah, yeah. We could just go in a room and fight on that. Another
fight. So I feel like I'm gonna do the double answer as well, just because, like, why not?
Am I the only one who plays by the rules? I'm serious here.
Trying to cover as much ground as I can, because I wanted to just say William Howe, who was...
Go with Howe, man.
I kind of feel like I have to mention Wolfe. If no one else is going to mention Wolfe, I feel like I've got to mention Wolfe. I kind of don't want to mention Wolfe too much, because, like, I know a bit about Wolfe, but not too much. I just feel bad, because the previous answer, thinking back, I'm like, I should have maybe said the Seven Years' War, because it is such a break between... I mean, I know it literally comes in the middle of the century, but it feels like such a break for the British Army between the first half of the 18th century and the second half, and how in the Revolution they are kind of building off things they've learned in the Seven Years' War, which in a way makes it more important. I guess you covered that by saying the American War is clever. It wasn't just the Revolution you were talking about, but just I should emphasize that Seven Years' War was really important. And Wolfe was kind of cool. Anyway, William Howe, I think, in the Revolution was the most pivotal. He's a pretty fascinating guy. He's a brilliant tactician, terrible strategist. So on the battlefields, he gets it right. He makes it look easy in many ways. He wins, I think, all his battles, more or less. He's inches away from catching George Washington around New York. He wins at Brandywine, gets the prize that Germantown still wins. He's a good tactician. When it comes to strategy, not so great. He messes up the 1777 campaign by deciding to capture Philadelphia instead of supporting Burgoyne, which then results in the first Patriot victory, which leads the French to join in the Patriot side. His actual character is interesting because he's pro-American. He was very against the war. One of the reasons he was put in charge was because the British ministry was trying to go for this conciliatory note where they were like, we don't want someone who's just going to go crazy when he gets to America and start, you know, really being very offensive-minded when it comes to trying to put down the revolution. There's accusations that that then caused him to hold back a bit when it comes to delivering the killer blow. Like, he can neither win, he can't do both things. He's trying to suppress the rebellion while being nice about it. But in terms of the purely tactical doctrinal sense, he's one of the big proponents of the whole, what Josh said, the American scramble. So there's really interesting periods after the British evacuate Boston, and the task before them at that point is mammoth. They've basically lost the entire 13 colonies. You know, you think they're suppressing a rebellion at this point. In reality, they're trying to reconquer North America, certainly anything north of Florida and south of Quebec. So he takes the army to Halifax, and he drills the army, and he adopts lots of these doctrinal changes, everything from uniforms to, you know, how units move, the open order tactics. And when they're next engaged at Long Island, it's a resounding success. So he does loads of really good things, and he kind of then falls down when it comes to the vital strategic choices. So he's an interesting guy.
I think Hal's kind of winning it there. I mean, I love Wolfe. His house, his Quebec house, as it's now called, is just down the road from me, and it's one of my favourite little places to visit. It's really fascinating. So I think we'll probably find an excuse to circle back to him at some point.
Yeah, in the future.
I was honestly slightly surprised that you didn't choose your man Tarleton, which you normally champion on Twitter.
Oh,
I thought about it, but I just can't. Well, first off, no cavalry.
I know. We haven't talked about the cavalry,
Oh no!
No cavalry here. Yeah, I mean, you know, I love my boy Tarl, but bloody ban. You're gonna get me into some sort of long-winded answer here. He's interesting in so much as he's a microcosm of the British Army officer class. Really don't like the rebels and kind of want to destroy them. At the same time, he's not the complete psycho he's portrayed as, but he's amazing for rebel propaganda. He's very competent. He's a one-trick pony. He gets his dragoons, he chases the Americans, he catches up with them, he attacks them very violently straight away, and because they're normally militia, they run away and he wins. So that's cool.
That kind of doesn't work for him at Cowpens when he's against...
Exactly. He kind of fluffs his lines when it really counts.
Well, he's up against a clever guy. Morgan knows what he's doing is the problem. It's not so much the troops.
I can't really... We're talking about sort of overarching big effect on the British Army in the 18th century.
Yes.
I can't say he has a big effect on the overarching.
No, well defended. You haven't done him in the injustice.
I think it's fair to say there that Wolfe, in terms of the reforms thing, he simplified the platoon firing system into, like, vastly simplified it, and also he was the guy behind the let's drop the bayonets down to the waist, boys, and not use it like a pike.
Yeah.
Carry on.
No, yeah, I like Wolfe. I really just need to know more about the guy. I think he's great.
Marlborough's army
paintings is his death scene, if nothing else.
Yeah. It's like Marlborough's army up to the Seven Years' War, and then it almost kind of becomes Wolfe's army in a kind of way.
Maybe I think we need to come back to a whole separate podcast about what if Wolfe survived, would we America and all that kind of stuff. But I want to ask Dorman his one.
It would have been Wolfe's army if he didn't decide to ride a horse at that day. I think it's a tough question to ask or to answer. I think Lord Trimalston, again, I'm being very Irish-focused here, but Lord Trimalston, he's the first person to advocate for Irish Catholic recruitment. His proposal, this is in 1762, he asks Irish Parliament, and by extension Westminster, for permission to set up a Irish Legion to go to Portugal. It will fight in the Portuguese army, but it will be equipped by the British, have British guns, have British training. It will receive training on the boats on the way, because we're not training Catholics. We're just not. So I think, again, in my own little microcosm, I think that's a really important moment, because it opens the door for what comes later with Irish Catholic recruitment. However, I think the most important event and man in British military history in this whole century was the officer who spoke French during Wolfe's attack on Quebec, who managed to blag the guard at the river so they could climb the cliff. Because if he hadn't spoken French, they would never have climbed the cliff and never would have taken Quebec.
Is that not William Howe?
I was going to say, that's Howe, isn't it?
William Howe?
I think it could have been, yeah.
Oh, good grief. Billy Howe has won.
That's really cool for like a junior officer to win this. And it's two votes for Howe.
Give that guy later on. Oh.
Yeah, there we go. Howe wins. Gents, thank you very much. That was a really interesting insight into a development, and then it wasn't a development, and then a whole century of warfare that kind of peaks and troughs all over the place with great, you know, British victories, losses, embarrassing moments, and just gut-wrenchingly embarrassing atrocities kind of thrown in there as well. So I really thank you. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. That was great fun.
What we came for, although no cavalry, I'm just moaning continually about this fact.
We'll say whatever.
We're going to need a separate, like, entire cavalry podcast.
Okay.
Because I don't know anything about cavalry.
Come and talk about Bannister Tarleton. He's a cavalry commander at heart.
I think we can definitely do a few more of these. I really enjoyed picking your brains and your expertise because it's your era and your lane. So thank you very much.
Happy to play part.
Thank you. And thank you everyone for joining us on History Hack. We've got loads more great episodes coming up in the near future, some really big names, along with our regulars such as Down the Pub and Hedge Hopping with Matt Bone. You can support us for as little as $3 a month to try to give us some basic subsistence, basically some equipment, some editing software on Patreon, and every help in this kind of post-pandemic world for the History Hack team is greatly appreciated. With that, you can join us then on a closed Facebook group and get some exclusive content before it comes out. So please do look us up on the link for Patreon as well. Thank you, and until next time, we'll see you on History Hack.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Elena and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join... There's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.